No, bestiary is a correct pronunciation. A lot of people say bestiary, but there's no A in bestiary. So you are correct, Jason.
Well, pop yourself a beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some movie clips, some popcorn fighting, fantasy explorations, and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxings, full month horror movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on, contests, and of course you know it's all about games. That's a slogan, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast. With the other Jason.
Welcome back to Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. Big show for you today. We start off with a discussion of how to run bar fights in old-style D&D games. Then we do some unboxings, some gaming recaps. I answer a bunch of listener calls. And then we wrap it up with short movie reviews of Willard and Ben at request of Joe Richter, Pine Sightless and Wheeler Woe. So without further ado, let's get on to the show. But by the way, if you're not interested in the Willard and Ben review, they're at the very end of the show. So when I start those pocket movie reviews, if you don't want to hear those, you can shut off the show and you won't miss any RPG content. So again, without further ado, let's get into that bar fight.
Three aces!
What the hell's going on here, Billy?
Are you cheating us, kid? Cheating? Me?
Bar fights in older editions of Dungeons and Dragons, in retro clones, copies, and whatever else you want to call versions of those games. Pretty concise title, eh? So what this grew out of an ongoing discussion I've been having with Rob C. over Down in the Heap, who does not like unarmed combat rules. And he doesn't like, as much as he likes swords and wizardry, he doesn't even like the swords and wizardry unarmed combat rules. So how do we solve this? Well, he's come up with what he's happy with, but I'm not really thrilled with what he's come up with, although I would not complain if I was playing this game, because I want to simulate what we see in the movies. I want to have bar fights like we have in the movies, and I don't know that that's really possible with regular D&D combat rules. So I'm going to refer you to two other podcasts as well. Daniel Norton over at the Bandits Keep podcast has put out a couple episodes that are directly related to this topic. And those were put out in April. There was a special episode on armed combat and BX grappling rules read through. And I will link to both those. I am basically going to admit that Daniel's rules work great for me, and I would happily use Daniel's rules with one or two slight modifications. I'll talk about those modifications. The other podcast I'll point you to is a recent episode of The Geomologist Presents by Carl Rodriguez, and I'll link it in the show notes. And in that episode, he talks about how he had done a bar fight in a Deadlands game and used Savage Worlds dramatic tasks. Now, and I think that's well worth going to listen to, as are all the Geomologist Presents podcasts. So I'm going to dismiss that from D&D, but I think the use of dramatic tasks is a great way to do it in games with skill systems and in other systems. I think the Savage Worlds dramatic task, well, Savage Worlds altogether is a really, really smart game. It's well put together, and it's better than the sum of its parts, I think. I think the end result of Savage Worlds, is more than the sum of its parts. I think when you just read through the Savage Worlds rulebook, you're like, I don't know about this. But but when it actually when you actually play it, it comes alive, and it is Fast Furious fun. You know, you're like, well, maybe this initiative with playing cards looks a little clunky, but it works great at the table. Exploding dice, but it works great at the table. So, the math doesn't really work. The D4 is going to explode more than the D8, but you know what? It all works great at the table. Huge fan of Savage Worlds. And one thing Savage Worlds does really well is allow you to scale combat, zoom in and zoom out. And one of the ways you can do that is with dramatic tasks, social conflict, and even the vehicle chase rules, which all kind of work off the same ideas. So Savage Worlds gives you a lot of great tools, and they work really great for Savage Worlds. I'm not sure that they're perfect for D&D, especially for older editions of D&D that don't have skill systems. So with that said, I think the idea of dramatic tasks are probably, if I was going to do a bar fight in Savage Worlds, I would do a modified. If you did dramatic tasks, so in Savage Worlds, if you're not familiar with it, basically the way dramatic tasks work is that and I'm furiously trying to get to dramatic tasks in my rule book here, but basically you have a limited amount of time to get X number of successes. So, and characters can work together to get these, but they roll against, they do skill rolls, and they have to get X number of successes in X amount of time. And that could work for a bar fight, but you're not really taking the other parties, you know, you're not really taking into account the other fighters. Although you do take account the skill levels of the players, so that's important. In their social conflict rules, basically you're doing opposed checks back and forth. And you would have to modify it a little bit for bar fights, but I think the social conflict rules could be modified really easily to do bar fights. And it's kind of like dramatic task, but it's a set three rounds back and forth, and you're doing opposed rolls. But again, this isn't really a D&D. So I will happily say that in Savage Worlds, I think you could do bar fights a number of ways that work really well. In fact, just regular combat to some degree would work fine in Savage Worlds because the way it works. But we're not talking Savage Worlds. And there are tons of other games that do unarmed combat their own way, which is great. But again, we're talking older editions of D&D. So what Daniel's proposed over his podcast, and I'll point out that you can get a PDF of these rules. So in the last episode that Daniel's put out as of this podcast, he has a link to his He has a link to his Google Drive folder where you can download not only his BX grappling rules, you can also download his OD&D using chainmail rules and a nifty demon summoning, a little document on demon summoning in BX, you know, how to handle that. So I highly recommend you check all those documents out because they're all really cool. Hopefully he's probably talked about it on his YouTube channel, but hopefully we'll get a BX demon summoning podcast here at some point. But the one we're talking about today is the grappling rules. And I put a link to that folder in my show notes as well, so you can easily find it. So in Daniel's rules, he takes the OD&D rules out of, I think, a Strategic Review 2 and modifies them some. And if you don't have the strategic reviews or any of that, if you go to Delving Deeper, which is just Google Delving Deeper or Delving Deeper RPG and it'll pop up. But it's at ddo.immersiveinc.com. And this is a game by Simon J. Bull that he uses duplicate OD&D rules, but it's reformatted to read easier. And Delving Deeper works really well. I played in Baramaze a couple years ago, Cody Mazza running it, and he used Delving Deeper rules. And even though it's just D6s for damage and, you know, really simplified rules, it worked really, really well, and we had a lot of fun with it. But if we look in Delving Deeper, which, again, is an approximation of the original rules, OD&D rules, that has the overbearing rules in there. And so Daniel's taken and changed up these rules a little bit for his own purposes. But we're going to come back to delving deeper, just in case you don't have copies of any of the original books. So I'm going to reference that again. And I'll have a link to delving deeper in the show notes as well. So basically, Daniel's rules, the way they work, are, and again, go to his podcast. He breaks this down much more detail and gives examples of combats and all kinds of cool stuff on his podcast. But I'm just going to recap quickly. So, you know, in case you haven't heard his, you know what I'm talking about here. But so the idea here, this is for when combatants are not using weapons. And he has rules for mixing weapons with unarmed and all these other things. But for me, if we're talking bar fight, we're just going to assume it's a bar fight. And so now we're going to roll dice to see who's winning that round, but we're going to play more narratively. So I'm not worried about if you grabbed a chair or if you're using a weapon, or I'm not worried about that for me, for a bar fight, because we're just going to describe a bar fight. So it starts off, but every round, both sides roll initiative. The winner gets the edge, which means they get an extra die in their die pool. Now, this is a big deal. So definitely you want to, and you know, that helps, because if you have a character that, you know, has higher initiative for some reason, because of their class or because of their attributes, they're going to act faster and have an advantage. So that's important. Next, each side's going to roll. Now, these Daniel's rolls. Each side rolls a number of D6s equal to their hit dice or their level. This is their dice pool. If more than one opponent's attacking a single fighter, their hit dice are combined. Then all the D6s are totaled, and the difference between them is a subdual damage dealt to the losing side. If one fighter is fighting multiple opponents, that single fighter can choose whether to focus their damage or focus their dice on one combatant or spread out evenly across the combatants. Okay, that's the basis for Daniel's. And then basically any damage that is a result is subdual damage, and once somebody hits zero, then they're subdued. Subdual damage heals 1 point per turn of rest. Okay, I'm down with all that, but I've got a couple modifications to that. So I like what we have going on here. And we do take into account people's level, but we're not taking into account their class. So what I would do here is I would change from each side rolls a number D6 is equal to their level or hit dice to each die rolls a number of hit dice equal to their hit dice or level. So if it's a zero level human, they're going to roll D6s. If it's a wizard or a magic user, I'm sorry, they're going to roll D4s. If it's a thief in any good system, they're going to roll D4s. If it's a cleric, they roll D6s. If it's a fighter, they're going to roll D8s. So that means a fighter is going to be more effective. You know, a second level fighter is going to roll 2d8s, where a second level magic user is going to roll 2d4s. It's still possible for the second level magic user to win that round and inflict damage, but it's more likely the fighter is going to be more effective. So I would make that modification. I would change the d6 to the number of, to their hit dice, that character class's hit dice, when they're rolling. For monsters, I might keep it D6. I think it would depend on the monster. So most monsters might be a D6, but extremely warlike race, like maybe hobgoblins, right? Maybe they roll D8s because they're more martial minded, right? So you just have to decide that and figure how you want to do that. The other change I would make is I would pull in, now Daniel in his document that I've linked to and he talks about on his podcast, Daniel later on has rules, additional rules for stunning opponents, for surprise, for using saps, garrots, all kinds of stuff. The stunning and pinning rules he has are not as bad as what we see in the original rules, or if you have Sword and Wizardry Complete, they have those. In Sword and Wizardry Complete, this is how it works. Basically, you do the same thing with the D6s, the pulls of D6s, but the loser is stunned the difference that many rounds, which is pretty punishing, which is why Daniel went away from that. But he gives that later as an optional rule you can do. I think what I would do instead is I would go back to the old subdual rules. And this is where we're going to use Delving Deeper, because it's handy and it's online and everybody can get to it. And in Delving Deeper, effectively, what you do is And I'm just read a snippet of this duel rules. After any turn which damage is suffered, the referee must determine the sum of subdual damage sustained as a percentage of actual hit points. Confidence is then, now in this one, it'd be confidence is checked by throwing a 100-sided die with any result lower than the percentage of subdual damage sustained, indicating the monster is subdued. We're going to flip this around a little bit to after damage is taken that round, you're going to figure out the damage they took, what percentage is that damage of the total hit points, right? And then you're going to roll D100 or percentile dice, and if you're all under that percentage, you've knocked the opponent out because we want to be able to knock opponents out in bar fights because that meets the fiction. So if a combatant has 18 hit points and they take a hit for 3 points of damage, there's a 17% chance they would be knocked out with that hit. And you could either keep doing the damage from each hit off of their total hit points, although I would do it off their current hit points. So once that combatant's knocked down to 9 points, 9 hit points left, then it, including subdual damage, then when they get hit for 3 points, now there's a 33% chance they're knocked out. So I like that because I want people to be all knocked out in bar fights. I want PCs to be able to be all knocked out in bar fights because I think it's interesting. But you don't have to include that part of it. But anyway, that's the way I would do bar fights. There are tons of ways to do bar fights. I think Daniel really has nailed what I like. The only thing I would change is the D6s to the hit dice of that character class and potentially up them to D8s for more martial-minded monsters. And then also I would potentially include the subdual damage, the percentage chance as a knockout instead of being something being subdued as as being able to cold cock somebody. Because again, I think that's interesting and I think it mirrors the fiction. But that's how I would do bar fights in the older D&D style games. Of course, other games are totally different and I don't think it's easy to make a comparison between that and, say, Savage Worlds or something like that. Unboxing. So, I have an unboxing for you. And this unboxing includes, as I pull it out, some USPS, or actually, I'm sorry, it's an Amazon Prime mailing package. And I believe I know what this is, but we'll go ahead and unbox it. I believe it's a DVD or a Blu-ray, possibly. I'm going to go here in the other room, and we're going to unbox this. I actually have a couple things to unbox. I don't know how many, if any, are RPG-related, so we're going to find out. But this first one is a Amazon Prime white mailer. It says I can just tear the perforation, and we'll see if I can do that. I can. Okay, so this is the 1983 classic direct-to-VHS horror movie, Sledgehammer. No, it's got nothing to do with the later 80s TV show that kind of made fun of Dirty Harry. No, Sledgehammer is it's arguably the first shot-on-tape slasher movie for home video, which is kind of its claim to fame. It actually is kind of an interesting movie. This is the first movie with David A. Pryor, who you might know from his famous Killer Workout movie. But his brother, Ted Pryor, who is a great eyebrow actor, stars in this. And he went on to star in a number of other things and be a Playboy centerfold. But Sledgehammer, basically a group of friends, they never say they're college, I don't think, but they're supposed to be a group of college kids show up at this house where some murders happened. And, well, of course, the killer's still there. It's a movie you have to experience to understand. It is a combination of bad acting and a kind of an interesting killer because it's a supernatural kind of killer. And, yeah, I don't know if I can really describe Sledgehammer. It's a so bad, it's good movie. If you like so bad, it's good, I recommend Sledgehammer. If you can't stand so bad, it's good, then you definitely do not want to check it out. GM Shadow's post-apocalyptic GURPS game. So this game is a post-apocalyptic GURPS game using fairly stripped-down version of the GURPS rules. Not a ton of options, which is okay. And it's run by Barry Dewey Robinson of the Shadow of the GM podcast. Other players include Minion of Confessions of Wee Timmer Spooshy and Arfed, also known as Darren Green. There's also another player, but I don't know if he has a podcast or anything, so I don't want to, you know, mention his name without permission. So to get you caught up, basically our characters lived in a village that's about medieval technology. There's who knows how long after some kind of apocalypse. We had had trade with the next closest village and then occasionally with a city that was pretty far away. Well, the trade all of a sudden stopped. Our trade party stopped coming back. So we were tasked with investigating what was going on. And so through the course of investigation, we found out that there was a group that had set up a roadblock and they had better technology. They had like an armored vehicle and they had modern firearms. And we had had some fights with them. And finally, we managed to get to the other village and have a sit down with the other village. And that's where the session started. So talking to the other village elder, we found out that this group of bandits, well, we're assuming they're bandits, had shown up a couple months ago demanding food and supplies and whatnot from the village. And, you know, they had set up camp at it was obviously a hydroelectric dam. And there was a palisade built around this dam. And the village weren't sure how many of them there were. He believed he'd seen about, you know, half a dozen of them or so, different ones over time. And so we went down and we scouted to see how many there were and when we could find out. Minion's character went up to scout, and he saw the palisade, and he saw the vehicle in there, and he saw one guard, and he noticed when they changed guards, another guard came out. But aside from seeing two distinct individuals in the vehicle parked in there, he really didn't find anything else out. So we go back, and we powwow with the village elders, and, you know, there's two scenarios we figured could have happened. This is a group of bandits that came from the city that are preying on these local villagers. Or they've been sent from the city to do something with the dam. And, you know, and they're not acting on their own. So if we attack the vehicle or whatever, we knew they had walkie-talkies. We didn't know that's what they're called, but we knew they had walkie-talkies and kind of how they worked. If they weren't isolated on their own, we figured that they would be able to call reinforcements. Because of the big trouble that could happen if a bunch more of them came down, we decided to go back to our village and find out what those village elders wanted to do. So we went back to our village, talked to the village elders, and they met in the council, and we were able to access the library while they're in the council. And we found some information on the vehicle that we saw that carried probably about half a dozen people, which matches the information we had. We also found out the dams create power. We didn't understand the specifics of this, but the idea that this dam could create power, you know, was concerning. So our village agreed to give us four able-bodied men to help us, you know, try to disrupt the plans of these guys and set up the trade routes again. And we went back, and on the way back, we talked and discussed what we wanted to do. And I think we pretty much decided we're going to attack them when the vehicle is there at the dam. So if we could like cut some trees down and block in the gates and keep the vehicle, immobilize the vehicle in the palisade inside their little fort, then we could wait them out, especially if they're just bandits and they didn't have reinforcements somewhere else. So we go to the other village to try to talk to them about this. And when we get there, everybody was down by the river. And when we go down by the river, we found that there were four naked dead bodies there on the riverbank. And that's where we ended the session. So it's been a fun game. I've only been able to play in two sessions so far, unfortunately, due to some scheduling hiccups. But hopefully I'll get to, you know, play it out. After another session or two of this game,
we're talking about moving on to Space Master, which ought to be a lot of fun. Definitely look forward to playing Space Master. But that is Barry's post-apocalyptic herbs game.
Unboxing part two. Let's see what we have in here. It's a big box from Amazon. It's nice and heavy. Nope, that wasn't very satisfying hearing opening. But it's satisfying seeing what's in there. I've got 1, 2, 3 books in here. Nice, fat books. Because I pull them out. We have Goodman Games, Original Adventures Reincarnated, Expedition to the Grizzly Peaks. Into the Borderlands. And Castle Amber. Yes, these have the original modules. These have 5th edition conversions. And these have a bunch of commentary and different things. So, very, very cool. I have not read them, but I will. Nice color art on the end papers. Very cool. Couple hundred pages each. Definitely looking forward to digging into these. So that is the second part of the unboxing today.
The Gemologist presents Mutant Chronicles. Carl Rodriguez, host of the Gemologist Presents podcast, has recently started a Mutant Chronicles game. Now, this is the third edition of the game. It's put out by Modiphius, and it uses their 2D20 system. I remember playing Mutant Chronicles back in the 90s with the original system. It's a Swedish game, but this system uses the 2D20. This is the second 2D20 game I played. The other one is a much more narrative game based on a world where giant worms and spice figure prominently, and I didn't like that version at all. I do like this version of the system quite a bit, actually. So the players of this game, really, Carl and myself are the only ones that have podcasts. Well, Arlen Walker from Live from Pelham's Wasteland is part of the group. He wasn't in the game last night. The other players don't have podcasts, so I'm not going to mention their names because, you know, I don't want to inadvertently put their names out there if they don't want that. But we had created characters, and our characters are all kind of... So Mutant Chronicles is basically near future, the way we're playing it. The time frame we're playing it in, because you can play it in different eras. The timeline we're playing in, it's pretty much a straight sci-fi game. No weird stuff yet. And we're on the moon. There's a city on the moon. And you have different houses, which are like big corporations and the old Earth countries that have been broken up. And so you have like basically the equivalent of Russia and Germany and Japan and the U.S. And... But anyway, our characters are part of a group working for Luna City PD, for the local police, and we're investigating some weird going-ons in an apartment building. We've been called in to check it out. So we show up, and we go check it out, and, you know, as we get there, everything's, you know, we know that there's supposed to be a patrol unit on scene. We're a detective task force following up. And so we get there, and we can't reach the patrol unit on the radio. We go to talk to the manager, and there's this weird program on the TV with this eye, and just it's like a weird reality TV show thing. And the manager's weirdly distracted. He can't really pay attention to us when he's talking to us. You know, it's very odd. We notice he has some CCTVs, but he claims they don't work. One of the characters is able to get them to work, but like I say, he's still really distracted. So we end up trying to interrogate him a little bit. We don't really get very far. So we head on up. Well, the TVs kick in after we get him running, and we see the patrolman upstairs on the third floor. And then when we try to rewind the tape, after a certain bit, it goes to static, and then that big eye from the TV show shows up. And it's really weird. And then then when we go back, the patrolman's gone off the live feed. So we haul butt upstairs. We get upstairs. Crickets. There's nothing up there. There's some blood drops here and there. And there's some open apartments. And we start investigating the apartments. And it looks like people just dropped what they were doing in the middle of what they were doing and left. And the blood drops were indicative of like maybe bloody noses or something like that that everybody had. every apartment had these TVs on, was tuned to the same program, by the way. And we did have to, the longer we were around those and the longer we looked at TVs, we're having to make will checks against those. My character went down to the end of the hall. He thought he saw something like a shadow in an apartment. He went in there and it was a burnout husk of an apartment. This building's getting ready for demolition. And he thought he saw some TVs appear and saw some horrific things on there. And then when he blinked his eyes, the TVs were gone. You know, he's having hallucinations. And so we pretty much finished on this floor, not finding anything. Although we did find an apartment with that had been a freelancer, like a mercenary, was in there, and we found his name. He was in our records, so we kind of knew who he was. And as we're getting ready to go up to the next floor to keep looking for patrolmen, because that's where the blood trail led, some gang members were coming up the street or coming up the stairs, and the gangs here think they own this area and they don't have any respect for the police or anything. So we all kind of ducked into apartments to see how it played out. And the first gang member, they got up to the top of the stairs and said, "Hey, here, come on out, piggy, piggy, piggy." Well, the one character was like a samurai in that time frame. And he, of course, couldn't take that kind of challenge. So he whips out and basically guts the guy with a sword. You know, just takes him out one swipe, which is pretty awesome. And my character came up and shot and took out one of the guys with a shot. And I want to say the other character took out the other guy. So we took three of them out, pretty lickety split. And then the others just ran and we let them go. And then we were there's one last apartment that we hadn't checked that we decided to check. And when my character went in there, he fell through the floor and so down on the second floor as he's working his way back up, this little lady opens the door and he's talking to her. She apparently says she was the initial caller. But when she turns to go get him a cup of tea, her whole back's burnt and there's like steaming footprints where she walks. And then as he looks around again, the apartment appears to be fire damaged. And, you know, it's like she's a ghost of a burn victim or something. And I passed the equivalence of a sanity check. So I kept trying to interrogate her and get out of there as quick as I could, not accepting her tea or, you know, trying to not be rude, but not overly accept her hospitality. As she was making some kind of sly advances towards my obviously hunky character. And so that kind of played out. He ran upstairs. The other characters kind of told him. And they were seeing different kind of hallucinations here and there the whole time. But she had said there was another girl they were supposed to be looking for. And she had mentioned the girl was going out, you know, girlfriend, boyfriend with that freelancer who we identified. So we head up to the fourth floor. And it's really weird. The floor has been kind of changed and modified into like a biotechnical incubator maybe. And we saw what looked to be that freelancer, but he was all tied up in electrical cords and hanging from the ceiling and kind of modified into something else. You know, if you think about the lady that gets turned into a cyborg in Superman 3 with Richard Pryor, it's kind of like that, and he's there. And so we try to interrogate him a little bit, and he's telling about being in pain, but then he, like, drops down and goes to attack us. So we have to fight him. So the weapons, of course, are a little bit more advanced. My character had a pistol that could basically machine pistol. So he fired a burst into this thing and was able to do enough damage to damage it and knock it down. And then the samurai came up and hit it in the head and did a lot of damage to it. And the other character was able to shoot and do some damage to it. And then the next round, we were able to finish it off between the samurai and myself. And then the building started to shake. And as we tried to get downstairs, the whole building collapsed. We had armor and stuff. And we all took some damage, but we did survive the building collapse. And that was kind of the end of the adventure for that first session. Mutant Chronicles worked really well for what we were doing. I think the system complemented the genre we were doing well. The firefights felt deadly. We were lucky enough not to get hit. Although I should say the creature did at the end did manage to hit the samurai and potentially infect him with something, and we don't know what that is, so we'll find out as the sessions go forward. But we now are worried about something weird going on with technology, whether this building was just haunted, you know, or there's something else going on. At the moment, I think we all just think this building was haunted, or somebody opened a gate to hell in this building or something crazy like that. Maybe somebody had a Hellraiser cube in this building they opened up. But like I say, the firefights were really deadly. They were quick, which was good. Weapons were well laid out. The nice thing here is instead of tracking individual bullets, if you fire bursts, it burns. You have X amount of what they call reloads. Some of the terminology in this game is kind of kooky. I don't like the terminology they use for a lot of the stuff with the guns. It doesn't make sense if you actually know about guns, but that's okay. That's not a big deal. Anyway, but they have limits where you can only fire so many bursts and things, which is good. Sorry, I was looking at text messages popped up on my phone from somebody. That's not very professional podcaster, is it? But so the firefights were good. I think the way it allowed us to do the horror checks worked really well. We basically have a skill willpower, and we're rolling will checks, and that worked out well. Carl did a great job with describing the creepy stuff that was going on. It was like listening to an audio horror story. Andy Goodman is talking over on Expedition of Grizzly Peaks about doing horror games and how to make horror games scary. Well, Andy should get Carl on his show because Carl did a good job at making you feel unnerved and making this whole scenario creepy and weird. So kudos to Carl for doing such a great job at that. I'm a little bit low energy right now, so I apologize to you for that. But Mutant Chronicles, really enjoyed it. It's a little bit crunchy. I'm enjoying playing it, but I like the world. This is, of the two versions of 2D20 I played, this is my favorite. But I'm not sure I'd pick 2D20 over a different system, to be honest with you. I think we could get the same effect using ICRPG, to be honest, or anything else. But I think it's working fine, and I'm definitely looking forward to the next session. Speaking of horror and gaming podcasts, or podcasts talk about horror and gaming, don't let the bigger footprint of Andy Goodman's Expedition of Grizzly Peaks keep you from checking out Safer Fantasy Crafting's podcast. The last three episodes of Safer Fantasy Crafting's podcast have talked about horror and gaming, and he has some really interesting insights in horror movies and horror and gaming storytelling, the psychology of horror, horror's relationship with comedy. He talks about a pretty harrowing experience he had in a hostel when he was doing a walkabout 1 year. Highly recommend to go check out those last three episodes of Safer Fantasy Crafting's podcast if you're interested at all in the subject of horror. Yeah, definitely a must listen to.
Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Well, maybe it's your auntie or joke by your spouse, but the operator screaming is coming from inside the house.
About your character in Mutant Chronicles, and you can publish this if not, or not. I don't think it's a big deal that the name is more westernized in its formatting. I mean, your character was a freelancer, has a lot of dealings with people who are not from that Mitsushima culture. And as opposed to Jeff's character, who is a traditionalist and, you're doing him a favor because he also has a criminal record, right? So it'd be pretty interesting, and it actually more interesting that little switch can be role played and brought up, and even in character, if Jeff's character keeps calling you by your family name and you say, no, it's this way, right? It'd be kind of fun. So don't sweat it. Well, another interesting thing about canon is, like, if you know the canon,
when to bite your tongue and speak up or not. And like something came up the other day, and I'll just say it, but I won't say from where. But, and I'm sure people will comment on this anyway, on that person's podcast blog. But there was a character who worshiped a particular goddess, and the GM used a symbol for a different goddess in that world for that goddess. And I was like, should I say something? But I bit my tongue. So I was a good boy, Jason. And I didn't become a cannoneer. I'm not going to use a cannon end because I think that term is thrown around too much.
Okay, those were from Carl Rodriguez of the Geomologist Presents podcast. And actually, that call at the very beginning of the show was also from Carl. And the next two calls after my commentary here is from Carl. But I wanted to break in here to say that all of Carl's calls here have to do with my last podcast. So if you didn't listen to my last episode, you might be wondering what he's talking about. I did a review of a product, a Bestry, last episode, and I kept commenting. I wasn't sure if I was saying it correctly, which is the call at the top of the show from Carl. And then I had a commentary about whether I was ruining the feel of the game for the Mutant Chronicles game by not following standard naming conventions for my character. That was that first call from Carl after the break. And then that last call from Carl had to do with, you know, my feelings that you don't have to follow a little literary or movie universe as canon exactly when you play in a game. It's okay to modify the canon of a universe to fit you and your gaming group. This next call from Carl is going to lead into a call from Andy Goodman of Expedition of the Grizzly Peaks and Grizzly Peaks Radio for his actual plays. And it's referencing a game that Spencer mentioned on the Audio Dungeon Discord.
Vieja Escuela Pulp. That's how you'd pronounce it. It means old school pulp. Pretty simple. You're welcome. Bye. Or adios. But you've definitely piqued my curiosity about looking up old school pulp or Vieja Escuela Pulp. And it reminds me, and it's cool that there's an English version. I could probably try to track down the Spanish too. But it also reminds me of another game with origins from Spain or Spanish-speaking authors called Aquelarre. Aquelarre, which is Diabolic Assembly, Coven, would be the translation. But, I mean, the book is beautiful and it's really laid out well. I still need to digest it and go through it, but I would like to get that to the table. Aquelarre.
Vieja Escuela Pulp. It means old school. Well, I think you know what it means. It means old school pulp. Vieja, old, escuela, school, pulp. Pulp. But pulp is interesting because pulpo means octopus. So maybe it's old school octopus, you know, and they left off the O. Now that is a game to play. Actually, the cover looks amazing. And I'd love it. I mean, I love pulp. I'm running a lot of pulp at the moment, and but it's pulp horror. So I think pulp action. Man, you're making me think. All right, see you, man.
Of course, both these guys are referring to a game that I talked to last episode, and it, as far as I can tell, maybe I'll put a link to this page. I had a link in last episode too, but it's Grappas and Mappas. Grapas, it looks like the ampersand symbol, Mapas. But there are a number of games on here. There's a pulp game, like say there's a horror game, Carnival Fatal. Actually, if you click on that, that's just a free PDF download in Spanish. There's a pirate game called R. There's a gladiator game. There's a space fantasy game, Vea Estrella. There's Cornabungo, which I think is like there looks like going to be a standard, like a fantasy game. Un Profundo Secreto, which
is a like a submarine under the seas. It looks like it's going to be like a oh, that's a free download PDF download too. You can just touch on it and it'll download it. So they've got a ton of these, and I don't know if that's like Dr. Nemo or what that is, or Dr. Nemo, Captain Nemo. But they've got a whole bunch of games on here. So I would definitely recommend checking out this website, especially if you can speak Spanish, because you'll understand what you're looking at much better than I do. Oh, you know what? Is this their Tumblr account? I don't know what this is. It looks like it's their website. So I'm going to put a link to what I'm looking at here. But that's what they're talking about. It's a old school game company. I don't know where in the world they are located. Do not know that. It's Spanish language, but I don't know where exactly, you know, if they're on the continent or if they're in South or Central America or if they're somewhere else. But that is what it looks like. And yeah, when I look at some of these comment sections, it is an ampersand. So it is Grappus and Mappus. But Andy and Carl, I highly recommend you check them out, because it sounds like you can maybe comprehend their books, and they look pretty cool.
Hello, Jason. I'm just enjoying your latest podcast, The Baroque Bestiary. I heard that you were asking for some opinions on the difference between science fiction and science fantasy. And it's not something I particularly worry about myself, personally. If it's in space and it's got laser guns, it's science fiction. I mean, I don't really particularly worry about it. But if you want to go down that little rabbit hole, I think typically science fiction has been defined by the removal of God, the removal of spirituality, the removal of otherworldliness from the scene. Everything has a rationale or a pseudo-rationale explanation. Science fantasy allows and makes rooms for those romantic notions. I don't have a preference for either, actually. I mean, I'm quite happy with science fiction themes. And like in Star Wars, I didn't like it when Lucas introduced the midichlorians. I thought he spoilt the Force by doing that. He should have left it. But if you want a quick comparison between the two, you just need to look out Fallout 1 and Fallout 2. So, yeah, the difference between Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 is a useful way of seeing the distinction between the two genres, because it's within the same intellectual property. Fallout 1 is definitely science fiction. In Fallout 1, you're playing in a post-apocalyptic future where humans have regressed back to more primitive and savage bases and tribal existence. And they're experiencing all these things around them, and they're ascribing spiritual, magical, otherworldly elements to it. But as you play the game, as a player, you always discover that each one of these strange occurrences, it all has some kind of rational or pseudo-rational, pseudo-scientific basis behind it. It's just been created by the leftovers from the previous civilization that was destroyed in the apocalypse. So Fallout 2 completely breaks that science fiction canon and actually introduces science fantasy elements. So the best direct comparison between the two is that in Fallout 1, you go and investigate what is supposed to be some ghosts in a place. Some tribe are seeing ghosts nearby. And when you investigate, it just turns out to be mutants using invisibility devices, stealth boys, to hide themselves. It's all got a pseudo-scientific rationale behind them within the paradigm of the world that they've set up. But when you go to Fallout 2, the exact same thing happens. You go to a place, there's a sightings of a ghost. You arrive thinking it's going to be someone in the stealth boy, and it turns out it's not. It's an actual real ghost. And also Fallout 2 introduces notions of like tribal visions. There's spiritual astral projections and things. It totally disregards and abandons the previous hard scientific rationale that Fallout 1 establishes. So, I just think that they are a really good comparison for understanding the difference between the two genres, because it's actually within exactly the same supposed canon, within the same product and intellectual property.
Of course, how is Safer Fantasy Crafting. And he, as well as a number of the following listeners, are going to comment on the differences between science fiction and science fantasy. I've been doing a series for a number of episodes here talking about that, and I've encouraged listeners to reach out to me and tell me what they feel the difference between the two is. And that use of a higher power or spirituality is an interesting one. And another good example of that is Joe Haldeman's The Forever War series. So a lot of people know the Forever War, published in, 1974, I think. Haldeman, I'm pretty sure Haldeman was a Marine in Vietnam. And he wrote about, hold on, what's going on, dog? What's up, Maddie? Yeah? You don't say. Show me what's going on, buddy. Show me what's going on. Anyhow, Joe, he wasn't a Marine. He was in the Army. He was an Army engineer, but he fought in Vietnam. And anyway, after that, he wrote the book The Forever War, which is kind of an anti-war book. And then he wrote a book called Forever Free, which is a sequel in 1990. That wasn't published till 1999. Well, Forever Free is definitely... If Forever War is science fiction, and I think it probably is, Forever Free is very much science fantasy. I won't say anything else except Forever War is worth reading. Forever Free is pretty universally accepted as not as good as the first one. So, with that said, let's go on to another caller.
Good morning. This is Taylor of ClearXware Ringmail calling in to talk about programming. I want to introduce the concept known as an interface. An interface is, simply put, a contract, an outline which tells the larger program how to interact with a particular portion of the code. For example, you may have the concept of a collection, that is, a grouping of like items. Knowing what a collection is in real life, say, your collection of role-playing games, from a programming perspective, the collection interface would define perhaps a way to count the number of games you have, to add a new game to the collection, to retrieve a game from your shelf. As such, in short, the interface provides a consistent mechanism to make change and use, and more appropriately, define the object it describes. So, how does this relate to the conversation at hand? Well, because the same principle can be applied to games or media. Science fiction, defined as a genre of speculative fiction that deals with the imaginative and futuristic concepts in advanced science and how it applies to the human experience, is an interface. If a game or movie provides that speculative fiction, provides that advanced science, it implements the interface of science fiction and is, by its nature, science fiction. But a key concept of the interface is also that you are not limited to one. You can implement multiple interfaces. With that in mind, you could say that Star Wars implements multiple interfaces. Star Wars is science fiction. It has the advanced technology aspects. It has the human experience. But Star Wars also is fantasy. It has the Force, that supernatural aspect and that hero's journey that accompanies Luke's experience. I would argue it also implements American Western, something that made it really stand out and is probably part of the reason it succeeded like it did. Firefly, which the conversation about Firefly in your last episode is what made me think to call in, I've heard it described as the Han Solo TV show that never happened. It implements science fiction and also implements Western, which hit that niche genre that has produced the cult following it has today. Star Trek is pretty consistently science fiction through all of the different series, but I think implements different other interfaces depending on which one you're talking about. So the original series is very much exploration, very much adventure, and has this idealism that was pervasive in the 1960s that human ingenuity and science would be able to solve our crises. Then we move forward and we see Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine is about political intrigue. It's about the underdog and overcoming oppression. Then we move forward into Voyager, for example, which implements both science fiction and garbage fire. But that's just me. And I guess to conclude, that's an explanation for how my brain at least formulates definitions that I use when talking about games and movies. Additionally, I think that's a good mechanism which a referee or game master can use, mixing and matching genres to create a novel and interesting experience for play at their table. And lastly, this actually might be a reason why so many people can't seem to agree whether a certain IP might be one genre or another, because it is that for them, but it's extremely possible that it's truthfully both. So, my two cents, good conversation, and I wish I'd been able to call in earlier for it.
Of course, that's Taylor from the Clericsware Ringmail blog, and you can tell from the thoughtful, well-thought-out response that he gave us there what kind of effort he puts into this kind of thing. And go check his blog out. His blog has tons and tons of great posts, wonderful information, definitely worth checking out. And I think that Taylor brings up the wonderful point that it doesn't have to be one or the other. It could be a mix of the two and a mix of garbage fire. So that's good insight. So next, we have Daniel from the Bandits Keep podcast YouTube channel.
Hey, Jason. Daniel from Bandits Keep calling in. You're asking about the demarcation between science fiction, science fantasy. I think it's hard to really draw a line, because if I said faster than light travel, I don't think that's actually accurate. I've read plenty of like fairly hard sci-fi books where maybe they're not faster than light, but they're right at the light speed and stuff. I think the difference is, right, so there's like levels, okay? So if you have like super fast travel in space, so it takes you a week to get to Mars as opposed to what it would normally take, I don't know, 2 months or whatever, that's science, more science fiction to me than if it takes you 10 minutes. Right, so there's different levels, and same thing with the ray guns and laser weapons. If you have a pistol you can put in your boot that can shoot a laser through the sides of a ship, that seems much less science fiction and more science fantasy than, you know, a big backpack that powers some kind of a rifle or lasers on a ship. Right, I think that's more that can be kind of believable. So if we look at something like Coriolis, the Third Horizon, which I've been running, I'm pretty sure there's not lasers there. They've got technology weapons that are kind of interesting. They've got space travel, and it takes a long time, except for built well before their times by an alien race. So there you go. There's science fantasy generally, right? There's these portals that you can fly through that basically jump you from one spot of space to another. So that's your faster than light, if you want to look at it that way. And to me, that seems more science fiction. Like, all of that feels science fiction, and I would actually, if that's all there was, I would say it leans in that direction. What makes it more science fantasy for me is that there are some kind of mystic power things going on, and there's also, like, space monsters, which I think generally science fiction is going to stay away from, at least on the most basic level. So, yeah, I don't think there's a direct line, but I think you can kind of, it's one of those things, you know it when you see it.
Thank you, Daniel. I think ultimately it's just finding out what the lateral limits for your group is. Don't worry so much about science fiction, science fantasy, as much as, well, if my group, you know, believes that having creatures that can live in space with, you know, space whales are out there and that's too much for them, then don't include space whales in your campaign. But maybe we don't need to worry so much about science fiction, science fantasy. But yeah, people that are more, you know, engineer minded and like grittier games than Star Trek, where you hand wave and do technobabble to fix something, may not be as appropriate as Star Wars, where you see them trying to solder parts together. Next up, we have comments from the guys from Biggest Geekus.
Jason, it's Randy at Biggest Geekus. So glad to have you back, man. Love the three podcasts you put up quick and in succession. I want to make a couple of comments. Mason have to do a couple here. First, love the Baroque Bestiary review. Man, I'm going to have to get that 100%. I'm digging old school. If you listen to our podcast, which I know you do, I'm getting into it. As far as Andy over at Grizzly Peaks, I have followed that. I think Andy and I are coming to an agreement. We may not like everything each other says, but honestly, that's cool. We're all welcome to different opinions, and I think it's really cool that you know, he spoke up, and that's fine. And it started a conversation, and he's commented a few times. Hopefully he can listen. And if you don't like our negative play material, it's fine. I mean, Joe and I are you know, very conservative and Christian. That's just the way it is, but you don't have to listen to it. It's fine. But I think Andy and I are more alike than different. He even mentioned that, and I listened to one of his podcasts, and it seemed the case. Okay, so the difference between science fantasy and science fiction. I think I agree with you, Jason, about Star Trek. I mean, think about the teleporter. Come on. Disintegrating and reintegrating people, literally killing you and making a cop, saving a copy of you somewhere in the cloud or whatever they have, that's pretty fantastical. Wormhole technology maybe is more connected to science. Star Trek always seemed to try their best to use, you know, science jargon that was real close to being, you know, believable. I think it leans a little more toward fantasy. But having said that, I don't know, maybe something like The Expanse is a little more grounded. I don't know where I stand. I probably lean toward the fantasy in terms of preference, but whether we can split hairs and say, oh, it's because you're using laser guns or because you're using FTL, I'm not really sure. Gonna have to think on that one. Great podcast, great discussion. Take care.
Hey, Jason, it's Joe from Biggest Geekus, and I'm calling because I'm listening to one of your previous episodes, and you're talking about Star Wars and Star Trek and sci-fi, science fantasy, science fiction. And one of the things that has always bugged me about Star Trek, and it's why I like Star Wars a little better and playing in that kind of a universe better, is that it's odd that every planet they go to, not only do they have a breathable atmosphere, but it seems like they only have all of these planets are monocultures, which seems extremely unlikely. I mean, maybe some, but not all. Also, on the van subject, I've looked into those too, and more power to you if you can get one of those conversion vans. However, you might want to consider maintenance. From what I understand, it can be difficult because of the compartment where you get to the typical things to repair is actually inside of the car, next to the driver, between the driver and the passenger. I remember hearing the name of it, but I don't remember it. The name of the of that compartment, but you have to get to it from inside the car, and it's extremely difficult, from what I understand. I don't know if that's a universal with those conversion vans, but definitely the newer ones. Talk to you later.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Really appreciate that. Oh, by the way, I don't know if you guys have listened to Safer's episodes yet. I know you said you might be a little bit behind, but over in Safer did name drop you guys over there, the Biggest Geekus guys. So, that said, reference the conversion van. Yeah, it's kind of a pipe dream, really, to be honest, as much as I'd like to have one. What I might end up getting, though, I've been looking, and, you know, electric cars are coming, whether we like it or not, right? All the major car manufacturers now, I believe, have stopped development of internal combustion engines. They're all looking at alternative engines and all. So VW has the Buzz microbus coming out. I think it will come to the U.S. in 2024. And go check this thing out online. There's an article in Car and Driver and some other places. But it looks really interesting. And the interior of the Buzz microbus, which is supposed to look a little bit like the old VW bus, but the interior is all movable around. And even the front two seats, the driving passenger seats, will turn around like captain seats. They'll turn around to face the back. You can slide things around. I think you can remove a row of seats. It just looks really interesting. And it's a lot cheaper than any conversion van, or it looks like it will be. So that Buzz microbus electric vehicle might be where I go. And just think, it's going to out-hippie the hippies because it'll be electric, so it won't even be putting out any emissions. Although, are we really saving that much energy? Because we're still having to make energy to power these electric things. So you're still having to generate all that electricity. So, you know, that's obviously, you know, there's no such thing as free energy. But anyway, that may be where I go with a conversion van. We'll see. It might be an electric VW minibus.
Hey there, Jason. It's John here from the Red Dye Stories. Just listening to your episode 202. Yeah, I know I'm mad far behind. I've had a couple of weeks where I've just been slammed with work and I've not been able to listen to any podcasts at all. I've got about 45 waiting in my queue that I'm steadily working my way through. Still listening to the episode. I've just listened to the bit where you're talking about your sleep apnea. I have a similar thing. I've got one of the CPAP machines and it does make a hell of a lot of difference. So I'm hoping that all works out and, you know, soon you'll be getting a better night's sleep. And I hope things are okay with the motorcycle. Anyway, I'm going to get back to listening to the episode, dude. Take it easy.
Of course, I was John Allen Large, the Red Dice Diaries podcast. Thank you for the kind thoughts, John. Yep, hopefully I have the CPAP in hand soon and a better night's sleep. And when I have a motorcycle update, I'll give it. Next call will be the last call, and it's from BJ of the Arcane Alienist. And all I'm going to say about this call is to look for something in early July.
All right, now you're talking about Lone Wolf and Cub. I would be happy to be a part of any discussion of Lone Wolf and Cub. I love that. I actually have not watched all the films, although now that I know they're on HBO Max, I will make a point to do that. But I did collect and read the entire series, oh, a little over 20 years ago. Dark Horse published them, just with English translations of the dialogue. But otherwise, and it took them a couple years to get them all out because they published the entire series and I consumed them all. And so that is, yeah, great stuff, Lone Wolf and Cub. I love that series. I'll go watch the movies and talk more about it when the time comes.
Pocket Movie Reviews, Willard 1971 and Ben 1972. Joe Richter, last podcast, called and asked me to review Willard and Ben. And so here are some Pocket Movie Reviews. I'm not going to give away everything, Joe, but I'll tell you, you could probably skip these two movies, to be honest. They're okay. Willard is paced a little bit better than Ben is. They're both kind of oddities and interesting, but they're not that great, and chances are you're going to be bored watching them. Willard has Bruce Davison as the star, Willard. You remember Bruce Davison from the original X-Men movies. He was the senator that got turned into a mutant, and he, you know, liquefied and couldn't keep his molecules together. His evil boss, who was his father's business partner, is played by Ernest Borgnine, who does a great job. I love when Ernest Borgnine plays an evil character because he always does a great job at it. Also of note in the movie is Sandra Locke. Sandra Locke, you remember, is Clint Eastwood's partner, who he put in a ton of movies like The Outlaw Josie Wales and the Sudden Impact, the Dirty Harry movie where the lady gets raped on the beach and he goes up there and it's the one where he has the 44 automatic. But she's pretty young in this movie, actually, Sandra Locke is. But basically, Willard, you have this odd young man, or, you know, awkward young man, whose father has died, his business partner has stolen the business. Willard lives at home with his mom in this decrepit house. He catches crap from his boss all the time. He ends up making friends with some rats on the property and trains them. And then his mom ends up dying. And eventually people find out about the rats and things go, you know, sideways. There are a couple rat attacks in the movie, which are okay. They're not horribly done, but it's not really a horror movie. It's more of just a weird tale movie. It's almost like a Twilight Zone movie, to be honest. It's more like a Twilight Zone episode than a horror movie. It's not very horrific or even suspenseful at all, to be honest. There are a couple moments towards the end, but for the most part, it's just more of a character study of Willard. It's okay. What ends up being one of the major rats is Ben. So Willard ended up being a success, and they wanted to fast track a sequel. So Ben is the sequel, which has the rat Ben in it. And in Ben, really the most... So there's two things, I guess, a note in Ben. Last episode, when I told Joe I would review these, I made the horrible mistake of misidentifying poor Meredith Baxter. So if you know who Meredith Baxter is, and you do, even if you don't recognize her name, then you know that she was the mother in Family Ties. Well, last episode, I inadvertently said Meredith Baxter was the mother on the Brady Bunch. Of course, that's Florence Henderson, and I apologize to everybody for doing that. So, that out of the way, she's about the only member of the cast that really matters. Not that she matters that much. She ends up being the older sister to a young boy who befriends Ben. This boy has heart problems. He's had heart surgery, and so it's an odd story where you have a Disney-esque story of this sick little boy combined with swarms of rats attacking people. One thing the producers of the movie figured out was that Willard didn't have enough rat attacks. So there were quite a few rat attacks in this movie with swarms of rats attacking people. But the pacing isn't so good, and the weird juxtaposition of rat attacks and sick little boy story kind of makes Ben a weird movie. I guess it's okay. Probably the most famous thing, maybe not the most famous, but one of the more famous and interesting ties with Ben, of course, is that Michael Jackson sings the theme song when the movie plays out. He doesn't sing the initial theme song at the beginning, but at the end of the movie, Michael Jackson sings the theme song. And you may have heard that. It was a pretty big hit. So, yeah, I don't know. I have a hard time recommending either of these movies. Of course, you can listen to Michael Jackson's version of Ben on YouTube. They're okay. They're, you know, but I couldn't recommend them over, you know, where you could spend your time watching something like, you know, Sledgehammer or Pieces or, you know, something like that instead. But, Joe, there you go. That's my review. Now, these are the original versions. They did remake Willard with Crispin Glover played Willard in the remake. And that was like 2003, I think. And in that one, they tried to make it much more suspenseful movie. And I haven't rewatched that for many years. I want to say that's probably closer to a horror movie than either of these two. But, yeah. So, I don't know. Joe, I would put them in the background and do something else while they're on, if I were you. But that's my pocket movie review of Willard and Ben. Okay, everybody. That's all I've got today. Thank you so much for joining me. I want to thank all my callers. I want to thank Rayotis for the art, TJ Drennan for the music. I want to thank you, the listener, for tuning in. If you have any comments on what we said, what we didn't say, on something totally different, feel free to leave me a message. You can use the Anchor app. You can email me at nerdsrpgvarietycast@gmail.com. If you want to attach an audio file to that email, I can play it on the air and make you famous. You can also reach out to me in the Audio Dungeon Discord. So that said, I'll see you on the flip side.
Who's on the phone? Maybe it's your auntie or a joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if the fiddle shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. I want some more, bring on the gore. Well, your butcher is a dustman and your moil is by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away. Rising and the world has gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.